Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Kyle R. from Zieglersville.
How you doing? I'm Kyle, I'm an alcoholic. I'm a little nervous. I haven't spoken in a little while. This meeting's like crazy important to me. This is actually the first meeting that I came to the first night out of rehab. And this meeting used to be giant. There used to be 100, 150 people here on a summer night. And this meeting's like very important to me. It's funny, I was with some friends the other night, and I don't remember when it was, but it was like early in recovery, and I remember sitting in the back, you know, in a long chair in the back there and thinking like, man, the day that they asked me to speak at that meeting, I'll know I made it. And it took 11 years, but here we are. I have a sobriety date. It's July 29th, 2011. I'll tell you what happened, what it's like, what happened, and what it's like now. So growing up, I grew up in a, white collar household. I didn't really want for much when I was a kid. When I look back at it now, knowing what I know now, I realize the sacrifices that my parents made to give me what I wanted. When I was a kid, I felt like, there was always something else that I wanted or needed, and it was like life or death that I had it. But now being a little bit older and seeing, what the sacrifices that my parents made, makes me a little bit more grateful for my upbringing. When it comes to drinking and using, it's just like everybody else's story. I started in high school. I actually started in grade school, eighth grade, I think. And I don't really have that like moment that was like, oh yeah, this is it. Like, this is my thing. But I do have that, like, I do remember like always feeling like not a part of. And then when I got something in my system, I felt more relaxed and I could like be more myself. And, the night would just go easier. The friendships the conversation, the laughs, all of that would just like be a little bit smoother. And, I went to a Catholic grade school and high school, and I grew up, I had this like whole list of things that I would never do. Like, I'll never this and I'll never that. I graduated high school and I like slowly started checking each one of those off the list. The summer that I got, my parents were like a little strict. So the summer I graduated high school, they were just like, yeah, you're an adult now, do your thing. Like, I used to have like this like strict curfew, and then they were like, oh, you just, so the summer that I graduated high school, I don't think I slept at home one night that year or that summer. Just constantly out partying, like, and then that was like our life's mission. Like, we would go to work, and then it would be like, I remember being in that situation too, I'd get so drunk, and then I'd wake up the next morning and I'd only have like 2 hours of sleep, and I'd be on my way to work, and I'd be thinking like, with two of my buddies who worked with me, and we'd be like, we're not doing that tonight. Like, let's go home. Let's like relax. Like, let's watch a movie or something, get some food and get a good night's sleep. And like, the day would be over, like 4:30 would roll around, and we would be on our way home, like, scheming how to like get the next one and how to go out and have another good night. And that was like that whole summer. I went to, I was an underachiever in school. So everybody else is filling out college applications, and I was like, I'm not doing that. So I had to go to 13th grade, Montgomery County Community College. And, I call it 13th grade because, like, you show up and it's like all the other underachievers that were in your class are there with you. And all the other underachievers from the other schools around the area are, not to say that everybody goes to community college an underachiever. I'm sorry to offend anybody. that didn't last long. I remember, like one morning waking up and being like, yeah, I don't feel like going to school today. So I like, I don't even remember what I did. I like drove around and did nothing. And like the teacher didn't call my parents. And when I showed up at school the next day, like they didn't say anything to me. Like I was like guaranteed they're going to say something. They said nothing. And I was like, oh, that was easy. And, so I never went back. I did go to one semester and like passed most of my classes, but the second semester I realized that there was no accountability other than the accountability that I was holding for myself, and so I never went back. So I remember my dad too at that time was like, the report card comes through on the internet and he goes, hey, like what's the deal with these like 5 incompletes? And I was like, oh no. And he's like, all right, well, you're going to be a man now. It's like time to work. And like, you're going to like, do what you need to do, like pay your bill. And that like did not scare me at all. I mean, I grew up, I started working with my dad when I was 10. I worked every summer. But like, also, that just gave me more money to do the things that I wanted to do when work was over. So I was not scared of that. Yeah, so then I remember my dad and I worked with my dad, like I said, we're like oil and water, probably because we're like the same person. And so we would butt heads and we would get to a point where, you know, we couldn't do it anymore, almost fist fight. Like, so I remember this is like one of the times that I had like quit working with him and I was like living on somebody's couch and, you know, I got arrested for shoplifting and then I got underage and then, just like one thing after another and there was like no consequences. You know, daddy, like he always did, was going around picking up the pieces behind me and making the consequences less severe than they should have been. And yeah, that's just like how the year and a half went. I just like floated from place to place, like got a new girlfriend, like lived there for a little while, realized that was unmanageable and then like move out of there and then go back home and work with dad again because, you know, he would always take me back. And then, you know, I remember like getting to like a pretty good place. Like I got a job that wasn't with my dad and I was like managing a car wash. Actually at that time I was just working at this car wash and, you know, we were like in the winter, I was making like crazy money, like $400 a day in cash plus like my paycheck. And that was like, for me, that went from like working for my dad, who was paying me like, my dad was paying me like food basically. So I remember going to this car wash and being like, yeah, this is it. Like, and so I get this job and I'm like feeling really good. You know, I get an apartment with like my girlfriend and some of her friends that she grew up with. And I just remember at that time, like, you know, we had this like beautiful fish tank and like, thought it was like the real world fish tank. Like I thought we were like the cool, like I thought I was the coolest. I thought I had like it all figured out. I thought I had the world like by the balls at that point. And yeah, I'll never forget the day. It was March 27th and it had been like a slow spring. So that was like the first day that year that like it was like, it like broke the 80s. And it was like beautiful out and I remember getting home from work and my buddy Keith, who lived with me, he's outside like, hanging out and we sat outside till my girlfriend comes home and then, we were like, oh, let's grill in the backyard. And so I remember, I went and picked up my buddy Dave. So Keith and Dave and I for the last like month or two had been going out on Friday nights together. So I picked up Dave and brought him back to the house and we all grilled in the backyard and we just like had this great night. Like all the kids in the neighborhood are out and it was just like, I'll just like never forget that like feeling, like that first day of spring. It was just like, oh yeah, this is awesome. Like winter's over. And, so dinner's over and we decided, we were going to go to this bar down the street that we've been going to for, like I said, the last couple weeks. And, you know, another thing I remember about that day is like, we used to go to this bar and we would like sit in a line, like the three of us, and we would just talk about like, oh, work sucks. And we would laugh and have like fun, but like, it was just like us sitting in the chairs and we didn't really do much. But that night I remember like people were buying us drinks and we were buying them drinks and we we were playing darts, and we were playing pool. I hate pool. And we were playing pool, and we were like playing music on the jukebox, and you know, it was just like we just had so much fun that night. I remember like, but I do remember like being like, all right, I've got work in the morning. It's like 12:30. I think I should go home and get some sleep because I got to get up in a couple hours. And so I remember like gathering the troops and walking down the steps to the bar is like the last thing that I remember. Next thing I know, I wake up and I like hadn't even opened my eyes yet, and my throat was like on fire. I remember being like, "What is going on?" Like my throat feels like I swallowed lava. I open my eyes and like there's all I see is fluorescent lights above me and like drop ceiling, and then next thing I know, like my whole family is like standing over top of me, and I'm like, "Oh shit! Like what is going on?" So, finally, they had me intubated. That's why my throat was so sore. So they like finally get this tube out of my throat so I can speak. They had given me this pad to try and write on, and I like couldn't even write on it. And I said, "Well, where, you know, what happened?" And they said, "Oh, you guys got into a car accident on the way home on Friday night." And I said, "Oh, well, where are Dave and Keith?" And they said, "Kyle, Dave was here. Dave went home a couple days ago, some cuts and scrapes on his face. He got a couple stitches. Dave's fine. Don't worry about Dave." And I said, "Where's Keith?" And they said, "Kyle, Keith passed away at the scene." So they had me in a morphine-induced coma, and so they had to tell me that 5 or 6 times until it finally stuck. Like, I would fall asleep, and I would wake up, and the same thing all over again. Like, what happened? And they would have to go through the whole thing all over again. So I mean, this period too, it's like such a blur. It's like a dream. It feels so real, but it, at the same time, like it's just like hazy. Like I remember bits and pieces. So I remember my parents. I don't really remember this, but my parents were going out to get something to eat, and the police show up, and the cop says, "I want to talk to your son." And they said, "Well, we're going out to get something to eat. Can you talk to him when we get back?" And he's like, "Yeah, sure, no problem." As soon as they leave, the cop comes in the room, and so the cop's asking me, I'm over 18 at this point, and the cop's asking me, you know, "We know you were driving. Like, were you driving the car? Like, we know you were driving. We know you're driving." And I kept saying no. I don't know why I was saying no at this point. I had no idea the amount of trouble that I was in, but I just kept saying, like, "No, I wasn't driving. No, I wasn't driving." Finally, he was like, "We know you were driving." So I said, finally, I was like, "All right, well, maybe I was driving. Like, you guys say you know I was driving. Like, maybe I was." Eventually, he finally got me to say, "Yes, I was driving." So in between that happening, and then they were going to have this candlelight vigil at the scene of the accident. So, you know, I didn't grow up with Keith, and a lot of the people that I lived with did, and like the people that were going to be there, they like knew Keith for years and years and years, and I'd only known Keith for like a year, well-ish. And then before that, he was an acquaintance for a couple years. And I remember procrastinating till the very last minute to like get in the shower and get ready for this thing. And then his sister and his sister's boyfriend were going to come to our house, and then a bunch of the friends were going to come, and we were all going to go together. And I remember procrastinating, like I said, till the last minute, get in the shower. And I'm in the shower, and I can hear everybody downstairs, and this whole, like, was I driving? Like, what am I going to say? Like, I'm clearly going to have to, like, answer for myself tonight at some point. What do I do? And I remember, like, sitting on the edge of the bed, and like hearing everybody downstairs and thinking like, dude, like you all got in the car together. It wasn't like I was drinking and I picked up two guys and they had no idea. Like we all kind of had an idea of what was going on. Like, does it really matter like who was driving? Like, I guess I'm just going to say that I was driving at this point. And so I remember, you know, we go to the candlelight vigil, and as soon as I get to the candlelight vigil, this like Mr. and Mrs. Lakata, Keith's mom and dad, they come running up to me and they're like, "Oh my God, we're so lucky that it wasn't all three of you, and this could have happened to us in college." And they were just so kind. I like couldn't even comprehend what was happening in front of me. I remember thinking like, how could you like look at me and say those things and like not be so mad? And they weren't. They were they were just so nice and so supportive and so glad that I was still here. And so then we had the funeral was a couple days later, and Keith had grown up in New York, so all his family came in from New York, and it was in Green Lane. And I remember being at the funeral and being just like, I don't know, like deer in headlights. Like, I didn't know how to act. I didn't know what to do. I didn't want to smile. I didn't, like, I just wanted to, like, not be there, but at the same time be there. And then the reception afterwards, and, you know, just like looking around, and like, you catch like a view of somebody like looking at you and like pointing, and like, it's just the most uncomfortable situation that I've ever been put in. But boo-hoo. So then I remember my parents saying, well, we're going to have to go see a lawyer because, like, you know, you're facing charges now. And up until the point that we went to see the lawyer, I had no idea the kind of trouble that I was looking at. So I sit down with the lawyer, and the lawyer says, yeah, you're looking at 7 to 14 years. They're going to throw the book at you. They're not doing a deal. They're coming for blood on this one. And I was like, okay. And I remember thinking, like, we'll get through this. Like, it is what it is. So the next, like, big event was the preliminary hearing. So we go to the preliminary hearing, and we sit down, and I remember, like, my lawyer standing up, and all a preliminary hearing really is to, like, is there enough evidence here to, like, take this thing to the next step, which there totally was. Like, had they just, like, had the assumption that I was possibly in the car, there would have been enough evidence. So my lawyer stands up, and my lawyer says, you know, Mr. LaCava didn't have a job, and my client does, and he's had his job for multiples of years, and Mr. LaCava's blood alcohol level was a 0.22, and my client's was a 0.10, and Mr. LaCava this, and my client that. And so I didn't see this happen, but in the middle of this preliminary hearing, the parents and the sister and the boyfriend, they all get up and they walk out, like, storm out, because they're pissed. And you know, the preliminary hearing ends, and my girlfriend says to me, like, yeah, they got up in the middle of it. They were not happy. And I remember, like, leaving the courthouse and going, like, right to the car and getting in the car and shutting the door and just being like, Jesus. And my mom, I remember my mom coming to the door and saying, hey, like, I think you should come thank your lawyer for what he just did for you. And I'm thinking, like, what? Like, what did he just do? So I get out of the car and I say, So this, up until this point in my life, like, this, I had never, like, done anything manly in my life. And this was, like, the first time that I felt like I'm not going to, like, stand for Keith's name being drugged through the mud. So anyway, I say to the lawyer, I say, listen, if that's going to be my defense, I don't want any part of it. Like, Keith was a good guy in life, and we're not going to drag his name through the mud to save my ass. Like, you just made me look like an angel, and I am not an angel. I am not in any way, shape, or form an angel. So can you, without dragging his name through the mud, get me out of 7 to 14 years and get me a reduced sentence? And he's like, I'm going to do my best. And I said, well, that's all I can ask. And, you know, I remember going after that, we went to this, pizza place, and we were eating lunch, and I'm like running through my head, like, and I say, Dad, this is what you're going to do. You're going to liquidate everything that I've got, which was nothing. At the time, it's hilarious because I had nothing. I'm like, you're gonna liquidate everything that I've got, and then you're just gonna send me a check. I'm gonna be on, like, a beach in Mexico, and I'll, like, sell snow cones or something. Like, my dad's like, what are you gonna do? And I was like, I don't care, like, whatever. And he was like, he's like, Kyle, for your whole life, he's like, I've been walking around behind you picking up the pieces because, like, I know that you're a good person. And he's like, and now you finally got yourself into a situation where I can't pick up the pieces of this mess. And he's like, you have to. So he's like, I would really appreciate it if you, like, do that. Face this thing head on and see what comes of it. Like, and that really, like, it woke me up. I mean, it really stuck with me. I thought, yeah, like, what am I going to do? Run for the rest of my life? Like, yeah, that's, like, it's probably the right thing to do. So I remember, you know, the resolve at that point was like, okay, I'm going to, like, see this thing through. Whatever happens, happens. I do remember, like, after the accident, like, all my friends would, like, go to the bars and stuff. I wasn't really interested in it. Like, I smoked a lot of pot, I'll say that. But I wasn't really interested in the whole, like, bar drinking. Like, every time I drank, I wasn't really, like, feeling it. And to make a really long story short, like, they kept pushing back the date. My lawyer kept pushing back the date as well. So they have to give you a trial within a year. But because my lawyer pushed it back, like, they had, like, an extra 6 months or whatever that was. And so they were going to do the trial before the summer, and then they called me, like, actually, we're going to do it in the spring. Then they called me, and they're like, oh, yeah, we're pushing it back another 2 months. And then it was, like, they were going to have it right at the beginning of the summer. And then they called me, like, a couple weeks before, and they said, oh, the judges decided to go to Europe for 3 months, so they're going to have your trial at the end of the summer. And at that time too, like, once again, that, like, phase of my life was just, like, it was like a dream. Cause I didn't know what was going to happen. I didn't know what my life looked like moving forward. I would have, like, gladly went to jail and given it all back to have Keith back. But, like, I'm not saying, like, feel bad for me, because, like, that's not what anybody should be doing. But at the same time, I was just like, my life was, like, in limbo. I didn't know where I was going. I didn't know what I was going to look like. I knew that 7 to 14 years changes a person. And I also didn't know what was going to walk out on the other side. That was the scariest thought. So anyway, they pushed it back. And so the trial was supposed to start on Tuesday. And they called me on Friday afternoon. My lawyer called me and he said, we got a deal. And I was like, all right. What is it? And he's like, 19 to 30 something, we're going to run them concurrent, and we're going to basically, you'll spend 19 months. I'm going to get you work release. Honestly, if they had come to me at that point and said 5 to 10, I would have taken it. The whole time, that's what I was expecting, 5 to 10. Because I thought, like, we'll get them down from 7 to 14, they'll probably give me a 5 to 10. And I was like, okay, like, where do I sign? So I go in on Tuesday morning. I had, like, written this letter that I wanted to get up and read. And I remember getting up and reading this letter. Before that, signed a bunch of paperwork. You know, after the letter's read, they, like, take me down from the stand, turn me around, put me in handcuffs. My mom's, like, screaming in the background, like, crying. Like, and I remember, like, getting on this bus and being like, all right, like, here we go. And, you know, next thing I know, I'm sleeping on the gym floor, Montgomery County Correctional Facility. Then they put me in the intake with, like, one guy's dope sick, one guy's a child molester, and I'm just like a deer in headlights. Like, the dude's dope sick next to me using the toilet, and I'm just like, oh my God, is this what this is going to be like? But I did get work release, and then so I'd say like a week and a half goes by, and they finally call me to work release, and I remember walking into work release, and it was so crazy because, like, the back jail is, like, so dark, and it's, like, so small, and then you walked into work release, and there's, like, actual windows letting, like, light in, and it was just, like, bright, and I was like, oh my God, like, this is so much better. And, like, when I talk about work release, 19 months, like, people are like, dude, you did 19 months. Like, yeah, it's like, it was like Girl Scout camp. I mean, I worked 6 days a week. I saved a ton of money because I had no expenses other than paying like $100 and something a week for rent. And then, I also at the time too, I feel like, I called it like soul searching. Like, I did all this, like, you know, I did a bunch of reading, probably not the right kind of reading, a lot of fiction. I did a lot of like I said, soul searching. I wrote a letter to the family, and like I said, I was like a big boy, and I like finally had enough, and I was like, you know what, I'm gonna lose weight. What's a better time to lose weight than when you're in jail? And so I like lost 100 pounds, and like I just felt like this was like this hurdle I had to get over, and then when this was over, like the rest of my life is like ahead of me. And you know, I do remember, like, there were a lot of guys, like, using and coming back high, and, like, I never did that. I was not, like, willing to, take the chance of, like, going to the back jail. But when I got out, the night I got out, how do you celebrate being in jail for 19 months? It's like, you go to the bar with your friends. But I, at that time too, I had this whole list of things. Like, once again, this whole list of I'll nevers that got longer. Like, I'm never gonna get in the car with somebody who drinks and drives. I'm never gonna this. I'm never gonna drink and drive myself again. Like, I had this whole list again. And, it wasn't long until I started checking those off again. And I'd say at first, it was like a social thing. It was like, fine. I don't want to blame it on this girl, but I started dating this girl and it wasn't the easiest relationship. Like, you know, when I went into Penn Foundation to get sober, I went in there with a list of resentments that was like a mile and a half long. And I remember coming out with a list that was like, there was nothing left on it. And all of it, I could see my part in all of it. Like, I could see that I was responsible just as much in most of these situations as the other person. So anyway, I'm dating this girl and it was like difficult to say the least. And, so I would like drink before she got, we would drink together, but I would like drink, you know, cause my tolerance was like a lot higher than her. So I would drink a couple beers before she got there. And then it would like make me a little bit easier to handle, or her a little bit easier to handle in my mind. Then it wasn't like those like two or three beers. They weren't doing anything anymore. So then I started drinking like hard liquor. At the same time, I don't know how I came across a script of, painkillers. And so now I'm painkillers with alcohol and I'm like blacking out, like totally fine, blackout. And then I would like come to and they would tell me everything that happened the night before. My girlfriend would be like, oh my God, you did this and you did that. And I couldn't remember any of it. And so, yeah, so I do remember, like I eventually messed that relationship up beyond repair, and she had a 2-year-old daughter that like I kind of looked at as like my own kid. And she was like, you'll never see Cameron again. And that like, that was like the catalyst that like sent me over the edge. So I like went off the deep end, was doing anything and everything I could get a hold of. I'm also on probation at this time. I don't know how I got away with it for so long, but, finally, I was like, something's got to give here. My drinking was like out of control. And my mom was also an alcoholic at one point, so I like knew about AA, and I knew like, you know, I'm also on probation, and so my dad's like, why don't you just call your probation officer and like be honest with her and tell her and see if she can help you. So she does, and she gets me into White Deer Run. It was like the outpatient program though, so like we lived in this house, it was a bunch like 7-8 guys, and then they would like take us to these meetings during the day. And the van would pick us up, and then we would like cook dinner for ourselves at night. So it was like rehab, but it wasn't rehab. You know, I went in there with like all of the best intentions. Like, I am getting sober. Like, this is it. I'm sick of this. Like, I'm not doing this again. And, you know, I think I was only there for like, I don't know, a week or so. And like, I'll never forget this. So I was like sitting in this room, and this girl walks in, and it was like the sky had parted. Like, this girl walks in, and I was like, this is what they talk about in the movies. Like, this is it. And so I met this girl in rehab, and I like fell in love in like 3 days. And I like get out of rehab, and I think within a week of being out of rehab, I had a needle in my arm. I'd gotten kicked out of the house. Had a needle in my arm, was like living in York, PA, in her parents' house. Then we got kicked out of there. At some point, I'm living on her baby's dad's couch. How that happened, I don't know. And then, from there, I was like, this is unmanageable, so I'm just gonna go live with my drug dealer. So I'm living with my drug dealer, and I remember the one morning, I like wake up, and I like roll over, and there's just like all these drugs like everywhere, like right next to my head. They're like just drugs everywhere. And I remember thinking like, if your parents could like see you right now, like what are you doing? Like this is not how I planned on my life like playing out. And I thought, all right, like I gotta get out of here. So my dad and I, up until this point too, this was like over a year, we hadn't really spoken. So I like remember thinking like, I gotta call my dad. I call my dad, and I remember like this was one of the first times too. I was like really honest with my dad. My dad's like, yo, what are you gonna do when you come home? I said, Dad, like let me come home. He said, what are you gonna do? And I said, Dad, I don't know. But like at this point, I gotta get out of here. Like I have to get out of here. And he was like, all right, then come home. So I ended up going home. And, you know, like any good addict alcoholic, like it only took me a matter of time to like find the people in that area that were doing the things that I just tried to get away from. And so that was like another like year stint of just like basically living in my bedroom. All of my money was going to like drugs and alcohol, and my soul was gone. Like, I was just empty. I would wake up in the morning and I'd be so mad that I was like still here. And, you know, you get that whole cycle. I remember waking up, I had just done entirely too many drugs that weekend. And I thought, here we go again, like another round of sickness. Like, you're just going to be terrible for a week. You're going to swear up and down you're not going to do it. And then you're going to go do it again. And I was like, I'm not doing this anymore. I can't. Like, so I remember calling all the people that I knew. And I said, like, do not call me about that. I don't want anything to do with it. Please stop. Like, and I did. I quit cold turkey. But like any good alcoholic, like, I found what I could substitute with. So I had just gotten off probation when I decided to quit doing drugs. And then I decided, all right, now I'm off probation. I'm just going to smoke pot. Like, I loved pot when I was in high school. I'll be totally fine with that. And I think it was about a week that I went smoking pot. And I was at this party. My sister was out of town. It was her roommates. And they were like, what's wrong? You can have one. And they, like, convinced me that, yeah, I can have one. You're right. That night, like, this just shows you. That night, I was hiding them in the kitchen, drinking them behind their back, throwing them down deep in the trash can, then coming back out. And they're like, oh, they just had one. Like, look at you. You're fine. And I'm like, I know. Once again, the list of things that I would never do, like, there was no list left. There wasn't long until I was, like, driving, going to the bar all night every night, drinking and driving again. And like my life, at that time too, I like look at that period of my life, like I was a tornado. I was running through people's lives and hurting everybody that got in the way. Like, no matter what, if you were in the way, you were getting hurt. Girls, family, friends, they were just like stealing, lying, cheating, just get the hell out of the way because like otherwise you're getting hurt. And I also at the same time, like, that's not me. Like, that's not the kind of person that I want to be. It never was, it never will be, and so it was like this conflict that was like internal that I just needed to like get away from, and I like didn't know how to. I could not stop for the life of me. And I knew it was coming. I could feel it. Like they say, like, I could feel it in the air. I mean, it was coming, and I like didn't know how to stop. Like, I could sense that it was like trouble was around the corner, and I could not stop. So I was driving to a friend's house one night, and I had probably been drinking since like early in the morning. I was working at this glass company, and I was like taking all the overtime. So I would go in at like 2 a.m., wouldn't finish until like 4 in the afternoon. I remember being in this glass company one morning, and there was this machine, and they would put two pieces of glass with this like film, and they would run it through this like, it would heat it up, and then it would come out the other side. And you would grab a razor blade and you would take the razor blade and like rip off the rest of the film and then put the thing to the side and then go to the next one. And they would come out pretty quick. So I remember going in there one morning and drinking and then being like, hey, let's stop the machine. I gotta go to the bathroom. And then go into the car and drink in. And I wasted at like 4 a.m. And I had cut myself like 4 times with this razor blade. And these things are coming out so fast. I'm wrapping my fingers with like paper towels and electrical tape, and then like getting right back to it. I didn't want anybody to know what was happening. Until I finally sliced my finger bad, and I was like, all right, this has got to stop. So I like remember telling my guy, like, I gotta go. I remember going to the manager and being like, hey man, like, I'm not feeling well. And he's like, dude, what's been going on with you? Like, you came here, you were like a star employee. Everybody wanted you on their team. Like, you were, like, the most dependable guy we had, and, like, something's going on. I don't know what it is, but something. And it was that I couldn't get up out of bed without drinking in the morning, and it would progress through the day. And like I said, I could feel it coming, going to a friend's house, driving down the road, one eye, and I'm like, I gotta pull over. This is clearly unsafe. And I remember waking up, and there's a cop at the window, and he's like, I'm in my mom's car, I'm on the opposite side of oncoming traffic, not parked very well, and he's like, get out of the car, we're gonna do a sobriety test. And I was like, bro, you can save it. And I like turned around, put my hands behind my back, and he was like, well, we're gonna have to take you to the hospital, take blood work, like I need to find out what your blood alcohol level is. And so, man, long story short, 0.22. So you would think that would be enough to like get you to stop, right? The next night, I'm at Wawa, I get a public intoxication at Wawa, right down the street from my house. The night of the DUI too, they're trying to drop me off at my house. I'm like, no. And they're like, no, we're dropping you off at your house. I'm like, no, you're not. And they're like, well, yeah, we are. And I'm like, no, I'm not letting you drop. And he's like, well, do you have any friends? Like anybody in the neighborhood? Like, I'm like, listen, just whatever you do, don't take me home. So he takes me to this like friend's house. They take me. The next night though, the cops needed to drop me off down the street at my house, and they knock on the door. My dad's there. My dad knows about the DUI at this point, and I am so just like ashamed and full of guilt. And I knew that my consequences had actions, and I had learned that the hard way. And like, it wasn't enough. It wasn't enough to stop me from drinking. So they dropped me off with the public intoxication. So that weekend's my birthday, and I remember I wasn't drinking and driving, but I was like drinking so much the night before that I probably was still like highly intoxicated in the morning when I was going to work, but I was too stupid to realize that. And then I remember like sitting in my bedroom, it was like my birthday, and I get this message on Facebook from Mrs. LaCava, who I hadn't spoken to in years. And it was like such a nice message that it could be taken as passive aggressive. It was like, I hope that your day is full of like all of the family and friends, and you're surrounded with love, and you are given everything in this life that you want, gift wise or something like that. Something to that effect. So nicely. I was like, stop it. I said, Mrs. LaCava, I do not deserve any of that. It is way too kind of you to say. And she wrote back something to the effect of like, Kyle, when are you going to stop feeling sorry for yourself and do something with your life? And that like hit me like a ton of bricks. Continued to drink that weekend, but remember going, so it's like Sunday into Monday, and I'm thinking, all right, my dad goes to work at 7, I'm going to like get him on his way out the door, and I'm going to sit him down, and he's going to help me. We're going to like figure this out together. So I like, my dad comes out the door, and he like sits down, and I'm crying, and he's like, Kyle, like, what's wrong? And I'm like, I don't know, like, you got to help me, I can't stop. And he was like, what do you want me to do? And I was like, I don't know, you gotta call rehab and get me in somewhere. And my dad was like, Kyle, you're a 29-year-old man. I'm not calling rehab to get you into a rehab. He's like, if you want to fix your problem, fix it. And once again, another thing that like really stuck, like woke me like right up. So I set out on trying to find a place, and, you know, went to, like, I had a meeting set up for the intake, didn't go to that, and then the lady called me, and she's like, listen, like, we have you first thing Monday morning, like, you want to come back, first thing Monday morning, the appointment's yours, please, come in, we can help. And so I did. I remember walking into Penn Foundation, like, scared to death, and I like, always say, like, if they had offered me at the front door, like, hey, listen, here's this, like, recovery thing. Like, it might work, it might not. Like, if you put the work in, it'll probably work for you. Or there's, like, this pill. You can just take this. It'll be over. I would have definitely taken the easy way. I would have definitely taken the easy way out. I would have. But I'm so grateful that I didn't. I remember sitting in Penn when the decision came across me that, like, okay, like, I wanted to die every morning when I woke up, so, like, what's the worst that I gotta go to a meeting every night for the rest of my life? Like, that's gotta be better than how I feel right now. And I remember watching people come in there, younger guys, like, I think when I got sober, I was so worried with, like, how am I gonna, like, make friends, and what's my life gonna look like? My life, from the time that I started using to the time that I stopped, it was a habit. It was like, it was hard to break because, like, that's how I dealt with everything. If I had a good day, I used. If I had a bad day, I used. If I got fired at work, I used. If I was laughing my ass off, I was using. Like, it, that was like my solution to every problem. Even not problems, that was my solution. So I remember, you know, obviously being scared coming out of there because, like, you know, your baby, you're getting babysat for 20 days and then they, like, set you loose and then you're, like, driving mom's car again, like, 29. And, but I remember coming here first night and, like, it's this big, like, circle at the end, like, 100 and something people and thinking, like, man, like, this could be, like, I could do this, I think. And, you know, I remember, like, a couple days out of rehab, too, like, sitting there, and I got in this fight with this, like, girl that I had been hanging out with when I was, like, my tornado phase, and she was, like, she was not, like, understanding what I was saying, and I was just, like, listen, I gotta, like, do this for me. Like, I don't know, like, what happens with us, but, like, I just know that, like, right now, I have to, like, put everything that I've got into this thing. And then I get off the phone with her, but I remember thinking, like, oh, I'm just, like, gonna call somebody and get some pot. It was, like, this habit that I had to break, like, it was my solution to everything. And I remember sitting there being like, dude, you just got out of rehab for like 30 days and you're like thinking about getting pot. Like, what's wrong with you? So they, like, said 90 and 90. I did like 180 and 180. I got a sponsor right away. I got in the steps right away. I went to a meeting every night and AA became like my life. I was so fortunate. A bunch of my friends talk about this, like, when I got out, I got, like, I had a group that I was, like, in rehab with, and we would, like, go to meetings, and then the group got bigger, and then I got involved with the Penn Foundation alumni, and then all of a sudden, like, I had this, like, we would get together on Saturday nights, and that was, like, a standing room only meeting, too, and, like, we would go out to dinner afterwards, and it'd be, like, 40 people, like, all young in sobriety, like, trying to get it, and I feel like that, if that didn't happen to me, I don't know where I would have ended up. And, like, it's so crazy when I think back on it. Like, I told you, I was a big ass baby when I got sober. And, like, getting sober, like, showed me that, like, you know, I never paid a cell phone bill. Like, I couldn't pay my cell phone bill. And so, like, I would, like, you know, I started, like, taking on these tasks. And they sound so silly now. But I, like, gotta check in. Like, which I had before, but check systems was after me. So getting a checking account was like cool. And then, like, you know, I actually started, like, pay some bills. And, you know, next thing I know, like, you know, I had to, like, go to do all, like, the probation stuff. And I was, like, doing that. And then, you know, I'm working the steps and, like, I'm meeting people. And, like, I started actually, like, pretty quickly taking guys through the book. And that was, like, huge. I took two guys through the book who, like, became, one of them is, like, my best bud in the whole world, and, like, we've been doing this thing together this whole time, and it's such a blessing. So I was just, like, on this trip out on the West Coast, and I was out there for 3 weeks by myself, and I was, like, driving down the road the one day, and I had gone on a trip like a couple years earlier, and a friend of mine, I was, like, the first solo trip I ever took, and a friend of mine was like, dude, like, whatever you feel out there, feel it. Like, if you want to scream, scream. If you want to cry, cry. And so I'm driving down the road on this recent trip, and I just, like, started crying, and I could almost immediately, like, put my finger on what it was. It was, like, overwhelming gratitude for the life that I am afforded today. Not monetary things, just the blessing that my life is today. Like, I am so lucky to be here, and I am, like, so lucky that I didn't die. And And I like try every day to like make that like my motto that like today I'm gonna make it worth something. Like I'm not gonna like let today. And let me just, I'm standing up here telling you that my program is garbage right now. Garbage. Like, but at the same time, being in a place like that and like knowing that like it's okay, like you're gonna be okay and like this is good and being grateful for it. So after rehab, I get out of rehab and the lawyer says to me for the DUI, the lawyer says, we're gonna put as much time as we can between the DUI and you getting sober as we possibly can. So I'm like, good plan. So they push it back. It was almost like 13 months. So 13 months I go in for the open plea. I'm guilty. There's no like denying it, but please have mercy on me. So I bring, you know, a bunch of people from alumni and all of these friends, and my dad gets up on the stand and my dad's crying. My dad's like, my son's life is so different. He made A his life. He's on the phone on the porch until, you know, just this like glowing report. I remember the judge at the end goes, when I woke up this morning and I like looked at your case file, he said, you were going to jail for 2 to 4 years. And he's like, you're lucky you brought all these people with you. He's like, 11 and a half to 23, and he smacked the gavel. And I thought at that moment, like my head went down and I was like, oh. And I swear that a voice in my head said, no, pick your head up and be proud of who you are right now and what you've done to get to where you are. This is gonna be okay. And thank the judge. And I did. I lifted my head up almost immediately and was like, thank you, judge. And I'll tell you that 11 and a half to 23 that I spent in jail, I walked in the day of, I had 14 months the day I walked in, and there were some of the most serene moments of my life were laying in a jail cell. Some of the closest moments that I felt to God were like laying in that jail cell, like having that relationship with Him. So it's crazy. This crazy story. So I'm laying in the bunk and we like get into the working pod. So I'm like, yeah, I'm going to have a job. And like, and then normally in the working pod, they put you in a 4-man on the corner. Well, they put me in a 2-man and I had this nice, fine, upstanding white, cellmate, and it seemed like we were going to get along just fine. And he offered me all these extra books, and I thought, this is awesome. Until the guard says, Rotaro, he said, you got misplaced. He's like, you're in this cell. So, and as they're doing this, they're like placing 3 other people in this corner cell. And I remember coming in the room, throwing my stuff on the bottom bunk, and another guy comes in, and another guy comes in, and the gentleman throws his stuff right next to my stuff. And I was like, that's my bed right there. And he was like, nah, it's not. And I was like, at the moment, I'm like, all right. Is it worth it? Not really. And I remember like backing down, which is not something you do in jail. But I did. I backed down. And I remember getting up in this bunk and they locked us down. And I just remember like wanting to cry and I just feeling like, oh my God, like here we go again. This is just going to be so awful. And I roll over and on the wall next to my head is this quote and it says, gratitude turns what we have into enough. And I mean, talk about like a God moment. It was like, it woke me right up. And I also at that stint there, I remember this guy who was a sponsor to my sponsor when I went in, wrote me this letter. And this was like 3 months in, all my good AA friends had stopped writing, and I was feeling very lonely. My girlfriend had left me, my girlfriend who insisted that we stay together when I went in there had left me, and so I'm just feeling like very lonely, and he writes me like, how are you doing? You know, and I basically write him back this like sob story, like, oh, my friends from AA, they don't love me anymore. And I'm just feeling so alone in here and I miss everybody and I'm so disconnected. And so I get the letter back from Todd and Todd basically was like, bro, like you've been giving a gift at this point in your life that like not a lot of people have, and that's time. And he's like, it's up to you what you're going to do with that time. He's like, go ahead, sit around, feel sorry for yourself. Like, Or figure out like who you are without all that other shit. Without the cell phone and the friends and everybody surrounding you. Like, just what makes Kyle happy? Read self-help. Like, don't let a day pass without doing something for you and your recovery. And I'm telling you that that letter, like, turned the whole thing around. From that point on, there was a time when I was in there, I got to the farm and I was, like, working on the farm. And there was a time when I was in there that I thought, like, I would come back here if there was no consequences. Like, we had so much fun. Like, we would be, like, laughing our ass off. Like, I would come back if there was no consequences. And, like, that's only because of AA and this program. And, like, you know, the thing that I was so scared of when I, like, got sober was, like, where am I going to meet friends? And, like, what am I going to do? And, like, my life, first of all, like, things to do is twofold. I'm, like, so blessed with, like, the amount of so much room for activities. And the friends that I met in this group, like, I have a group of guys that are, like, my brothers. They are my brothers, that I never had. And I am so grateful for them. And although my program is garbage, they are the ones that hold me accountable from time to time when I need it. And those are the people that I surround myself with. Like, I've been so lucky. And I just don't ever want to forget that. I feel like this life is a blessing, and like, I am so grateful. And it's all because of this program. So if you're struggling, if you're just coming in, just stick with it. It's not always going to be easy, but life isn't easy. But I'll tell you that if you put like 1/10 of what you put into like drinking and using into this program, like, it will work. And your life will change. And, you know, they say when you come in, you have a life beyond your wildest dreams. And I thought, all right, I'm down. Like, a perfect smoking hot 10 girlfriend, driving a BMW, and like an easy $500,000 house. And like, I don't have any of that stuff today. And my life is so good. Like, things will happen to me and I go, oh, yeah, I could have never imagined in a million years. Like, that's the life beyond your wildest dreams. Like, I could have never in a million years. If you had asked me to write down what my life would look like, I still remember probably sitting in that back when I was like thinking, oh, when they asked me to speak at this meeting, I've made it. I thought 3 months was like an accomplishment, and it is an accomplishment. I mean, because when I came in here, I couldn't get 3 days or 3 minutes. So, thanks. That's all I got. Thanks for letting me share.